welcome to the KTEP Book Club on Perspectives. I'm your host, Louis Sines. And joining us today is Dr. Martha Hodes. Martha Hodes is a professor of history at the New York University. She is the author of two previous prize-winning books, The Sea Captain's Wife, A True Story of Love, Race, and War in the 19th Century, and White Women, Black Men, Illicit Sex in the 19th Century South. And her latest book is Mourning Lincoln. And, of course, this is the year that we commemorate and remember the end of the Civil War, Lee's surrender at Appomattox Courthouse, and then also, of course, the tragic assassination of President Lincoln 150 years ago. And as I mentioned, Dr. Hodes, Martha, is here to join us talking about her book, Mourning Lincoln. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's talk a little bit about this. As I read the titles of your other books, this is a big difference from the other books, although kind of in the same line, I guess, because of the Civil War, the second book. But talk about Mourning Lincoln, and I like the way that you opened up because you compare things like, gosh, what would have been like for us? And you compare the assassination of President Kennedy. You talk about 9/11. I don't remember if you mentioned the space shuttle or not, but that would probably be another event. So on that note, let's get started on how can people relate to the assassination of not only a great president, but the first president ever assassinated, because the guy who tried to get President Jackson didn't succeed. How can people relate to that?
Well, first of all, you're absolutely right that all of my books are about the Civil War, so that's the thread that joins them. That's a wonderful question about how people can relate. I think, first of all, people still consider Abraham Lincoln to have been one of the greatest presidents in the United States. So even thinking back on what it must have been like then elicits some kind of response to many present-day Americans. I also think you brought up some very important points about 9/11 and JFK. I don't mention the space shuttle, but that's also a wonderful example. The assassination of Martin Luther King would be another wonderful example. So these are moments in which it feels as if the whole world has stopped, the world has come to a halt, and everybody around you is grieving and in shock. And in fact, I was in New York City on the morning of 9/11, and when I thought back on hearing the first plane hit the tower, then leaving my apartment and seeing in front of my eyes the orange ball of fire as the second plane came in from the other side, as I thought back on that day while I was writing Mourning Lincoln, I remembered a feeling of the whole world stopping. I remembered a feeling of everybody, the whole world, seeming to be in grief and in shock. And yet, when I researched Mourning Lincoln, I realized that although people back then also felt like the whole world had stopped and wrote down in their diaries and letters that it had, they also knew that the world hadn't stopped. And when I went back to some of the scrapbooks and relics I had collected for 9/11 and back to my journal that I had written that day, I realized the same thing was true. So just to give an example, people walked their dogs, people had their children to feed. We all went out and bought flowers to put on the memorial shrines in Washington Square Park. I live near there. And of course, there was somebody working in those delis and selling us those flowers. The same thing was true on April 14th and 15th, 1865. Many of the stores closed, but stores that were selling black material, black mourning drapes, stayed open and made sales. And people had to continue doing some of the normal things they do every day. And they wrote about that in their diaries and letters. So a woman might say something like, the president was assassinated, my baby was sick and kept me up all night. So there was a feeling, there certainly was, genuine shock. But one of the interesting things was that the world did not come to a halt.
Interesting, though, as you mentioned that, it did not come to a halt. However, Lincoln, as a person, perhaps, you know, his reputation, his character, his integrity did reach across the world. And other historians have written about the fact, tell the famous Leo Tolstoy story about when he's visiting a native tribe and they want to know about the great person, this Abraham Lincoln, and they wanted a picture of him.
Right, that's right. Well, you know, Lincoln's reputation did reach across the world, but it's really important at this point in the conversation to make another point that I found, which is that not everybody did mourn Lincoln's assassination. And there are two groups principal among these were the Confederates, who had just been defeated. But it's also important, and I'll say a word about this in a moment, to talk about Northerners, white Northerners, who were not friends of Lincoln. So one of the other things that really struck me was, even though it felt like to Lincoln's mourners that everybody was grieving, and Lincoln's mourners would write things in their diaries and letters like North and South are grieving together, and Lincoln knew no North, no South, only his country. Well, that wasn't true, and of course they knew that wasn't true. It was a kind of symbolic expression of mourning. So Confederates wrote in their diaries and letters, and sometimes spoke aloud, a certain kind of glee. They cheered into their private writings. They would write, hurrah, old Abe Lincoln has been assassinated. A woman from Texas, I found a letter she wrote where she wrote, I glory in the assassinator. For Confederates, the assassination was almost like a moment of relief in the terrible darkness of surrender and defeat. And they knew that it wasn't lasting relief, but it was a moment where they felt like, you know, God had let this happen in some ways to redress Confederate defeat, because they were still trying to figure out why God hadn't let the Confederacy win. So that's very important. The other group is the so-called Copperheads. Those are members of the Northern Democratic Party who were Lincoln's antagonists, and they did not love Lincoln. And this included, by the way, certain Union soldiers. So here were people who, in the middle of a New England town or upstate New York or wherever they might be, or in the South among Union troops, people would be laughing or cheering or clapping or saying things about Lincoln, joking. One man joked that after John Wilkes Booth shot him in the head, he has as much of a brain now as he ever had. And those kinds of statements and actions got recorded by Lincoln's mourners. And again, what's so fascinating is these mourners are writing in their diaries, everybody's mourning, North and South are grieving together. And then in the next sentence, a mourner will recount somebody in the town who was cheering on Lincoln's assassination. So again, they know it's not universal, but there's a need to express it that way.
As you mentioned, the Civil War, you know, it was brothers against brothers, cousins against cousins, a lot of family members involved in that war. And in fact, Teddy Roosevelt, you know, his father was a Union man and his mother was a Southern Belle, and she was devoted to the South. So when this happened, would you agree that perhaps, you know, it's been said that after the war ended that a lot of people, you know, would cross the lines and start embracing each other, and all of a sudden they were friends like nothing had happened before, or cousins? Did the assassination do anything like this, or did it pull people apart more?
Well, the first thing I'd say is that the idea that when the war was over there was reconciliation is a very particular narrative that mostly comes from white Southerners and white Northerners. So African Americans were omitted from that narrative, and that wasn't their narrative of the war. So I think we need to be careful. We often find those statements in memoirs that came later, in the decades later, the decades of reconciliation. What I found by reading hundreds and hundreds of personal writings, diaries, and letters from the spring and summer of 1865 is that the assassination absolutely did not unite North and South. And that's really one of the major findings of the story I tell in Mourning Lincoln. And even just to address what you said about divided families, brother against brother, sister against sister, I found an example of a young Northern woman who was engaged to marry a man who was fighting for the Confederacy. She was a Union supporter. And it seemed as if all through the war, you know, he would come home and they would get married. Then when Lincoln was assassinated, she wrote her mother a letter and called off the wedding. And not only did she call off the wedding, but she wrote, perhaps in a heated moment, but we don't know, she wrote death to all traitors. And then she was very clear that she was referring to her fiancé. So she was that angry. I also have evidence of family members writing to other family members, you know, north to south, south to north. These are white families, really not succeeding in reconciling themselves to what has now come to pass. So in a way, what Lincoln's assassination did was it highlighted and brought into relief the fact that if the war on the battlefield was over, the war off the battlefield was not over.
We are visiting with Dr. Martha Hodes. Dr. Hodes is the author of the recent book, Mourning Lincoln, and it chronicles mourning on the fact on the side of the people and how the country handled President Lincoln's assassination. You mentioned earlier about the fact that, you know, history books and other perhaps journalists write about that this was more of a white person's end to the war and their terms, etc. How did the African Americans relate to the president's assassination, because when he went earlier and was walking, I have to refresh my memory, where he was to visit right before he was killed, they were praising him, bowing before him, and calling him, the Moses of the black people.
Yeah, that's a wonderful question and very important, because when we talk about Lincoln's assassination, we can't just talk about the North and the South. We have to remember that the South was composed of white Southerners who were Confederates and black Southerners who were on the side of the Union. So we have to always talk about Confederates or Union supporters. African Americans, so interesting, had been critical of Lincoln early in the war because of his slowness to act on emancipation. And by the way, they were joined by white allies, by white abolitionists and white radical abolitionists. Then, over the course of the war, Lincoln was deeply influenced by both black abolitionists and white abolitionists. And of course, he did issue the Emancipation Proclamation, which followed in the footsteps of African Americans who had been running to the lines of freedom all along. And then, of course, with the second inaugural address, 6 weeks before he was assassinated, Lincoln made clear that the war had been about slavery. And he made this statement that, by the way, was already famous by the time he was assassinated, where he said, "Every drop of blood drawn with the lash," meaning slavery, "shall be paid by another drawn with the sword," meaning on the battlefield. So when Lincoln was assassinated, African Americans were in very, very deep grief. And even white mourners who were devastated acknowledged in their private writings that it was worse for African Americans than it was for themselves. So there was a great deal of a sense that they had lost an intimate, a relative. There was a former slave who said she felt as if her mother and father had died at the same time. There was a real trepidation about the future. I found a document where a northern teacher was teaching in the South. She was a missionary, and she was teaching down south in Virginia. And when news came to her classroom, one of her little pupils, who was 5 or 6 years old, asked her if he was going to have to be a slave again. So there was a real sense of fear, and also a sense that Confederates, African Americans, understood that Confederates weren't necessarily willing to give up at this moment. So there was a reverence for Lincoln, and also, in a way, what African Americans and their white allies did at the moment of the assassination, or just after, was they refashioned Lincoln maybe into more of a radical than he actually had been. We don't know what he would have been had he lived. But they took the few statements he'd made about black suffrage at the end of the war, and they employed those, both genuinely but also politically and strategically, to say to his successor, Andrew Johnson, President Andrew Johnson, "Look what your noble predecessor would have done, and please follow in his footsteps." They literally sent petitions to the White House, to President Andrew Johnson, and went to visit him at the White House, and implored him to follow up on freedom with not just freedom, but also equality, suffrage, land, education, all of the things that they wanted as free Americans.
We are visiting with Dr. Martha Hodes, and she is the author of the book Mourning Lincoln. And Ms. Dr. Hodes teaches, is a professor of history at New York University. And one of the things, Martha, that you were talking about a little while ago is the fact that, you know, people were mourning openly, and the fear that the African Americans had. I think it's interesting, too, and the listener ought to note that the way your book is written out in chapters, just to name some of the chapters, the way you follow. First of all, you start off with what happened, Good Friday, and then victory and defeat, shock, glee, God, blame, funeral. And I think just those words alone tell a lot about what President Lincoln's assassination meant to the public in general.
Yes, that's right. So you're absolutely right. I have structured the book like the story that it was, the story of what people experienced, beyond the public sources that most scholars use when they write about the assassination. So in other words, beyond the sermons and the newspapers and the public official expressions of condolence, all of which are important. But in order to tell the story of what people experienced, both North and South, black and white, soldier and civilian, men and women, I do move from the end of the war, victory and defeat, to the immediate experience of shock, the glee of Confederates. God is the chapter of people wrestling with faith. Blame is about who was responsible for this. Was it John Wilkes Booth? Was it something larger than Booth? I talk about the funeral. I talk about everyday life. That was what we talked about earlier, Louie, about everyday life going on. I talk about the fact there's another chapter that follows the everyday life chapter about other deaths, everyday loss, I call it, all the other deaths that people North and South experienced in the Civil War. And then the last chapters of the book are about the future of the nation and the quest for justice on the part not only of African Americans, but also how Confederates understand justice for themselves.
At the beginning of the book, you follow a couple of people, first a husband and wife, the Browns, and then Mr. Dorman. Tell us a little bit about them.
Yeah. So I also structure the book to make it more story-like by following three protagonists through from the end of the war all the way to the beginning of July when four of the conspirators were executed. So the first two are Sarah and Albert Brown. They're a white abolitionist couple from Salem, Massachusetts, and they're utterly devastated at Lincoln's assassination. The third protagonist is a man named Rodney Dorman. He's living in Jacksonville, Florida, under Union occupation, and he is an absolute diehard rebel. He despises Lincoln, and he completely and utterly rejoices at the assassination, but he's still very angry. It's not enough to make him let go of the anger of losing the war. So I followed these three characters, real-life people, but I call them characters, through the narrative because they represent two ends of the ideological spectrum, the abolitionists, the radical abolitionists on the one hand, and the diehard rebel on the other. But the other reason I follow them through, and this is the historian's reason, but it also makes it more enjoyable for the reader, is that there was so much material. So Albert and Sarah Brown wrote each other long letters because Albert was working for the Union Army down south in South Carolina. And then Sarah also kept a diary up north in Salem. So together, that was an enormous amount of material, and Rodney Dorman kept a very long and detailed diary from 1865 that's been saved, that ended up in the Library of Congress, and it was just so full of information about his feelings, his responses, his politics. So when you put those together, you have such rich sources to tell the story.
Now, when you're talking about, you know, it's hard to imagine, but you write it very carefully. You explain it. I mean, I pictured everything in my mind, despite the fact that I've seen movies, I've documentaries, etc. But when you write about the president being shot, being carried across the street to the Peterson House, and the fact that, you know, these people are seeing, I guess, that their president is human after all, and they're taking him up these steps. And then at that point, we see another side to Stanton as well, because he takes charge and he is very much, despite his odds, you know, with his the other team of rivalists, the fact that he is very much emotionally on a roller coaster.
Yes, that's right. So the very moment of the assassination is it was so fascinating to research because even putting aside all the memoirs, I don't use memoirs in the book because I wanted to stay in the moment, you can still see what all of these people are going through. So the moment in the theater, of course, is a big one, and I used as many sources as I could find in which witnesses wrote down how they were feeling. And then, as you mentioned, Lincoln is carried. He's carried across the street to the boarding house, Peterson's boarding house, because the White House is simply too far away for a man who's so gravely wounded. And then at Peterson House, Edwin Stanton, the Secretary of War, takes charge because he immediately opens the investigation into this murder. Of course, nobody knows what's going on, although I should say people had recognized the Shakespearean actor John Wilkes Booth as he jumped to the stage, but no one knew if it was part of a wider conspiracy. So Stanton is already interviewing people to be witnesses. In the meantime, Mary Lincoln, who's completely traumatized because she was sitting next to her husband when he was shot before her eyes, so today we would say, I guess, she has PTSD. And I also must say that a recent guest on your program talked beautifully about Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis's PTSD in the face of Kennedy's assassination. And something similar could be said in modern-day terms about Mary Lincoln.
We're visiting with Professor Martha Hodes. She is the author of the book, Mourning Lincoln. Now, Martha, as you just mentioned, God here, a lot of people were, as you mentioned earlier, the fact that people were wondering, why did God allow this to happen? And there was a big comparison because he died on Good Friday to him and Christ. And then also the fact that, you know, he was elevated and him and John Brown were almost like one started it and the other one finished it.
Yes, it's very interesting. I was very interested in people's religious struggles, their spiritual struggles. So here's a moment talking about Lincoln's mourners, not his antagonists. Here's a moment where Union victory, people understood to be an act of divine will. God had wanted the Union to win the war. And then why, in a matter of days afterwards, would he take away Abraham Lincoln? So people really struggled with this problem. And the ministers, by the way, struggled too, because they had just written their Easter Sunday sermons. So they had to go back, and within less than a day, they had to rewrite these sermons, retaining some of the joy of Easter Sunday, but also somehow grappling with this question of God's intention. And they didn't necessarily have the answer either. And you're absolutely right about Lincoln's elevation. I expected to find the elevation of Lincoln, or the idea that Lincoln was the best friend, especially of Confederates, to be something that came later, later in the century. And yet, that very day, Saturday, April 15th, even Confederates who were celebrating Lincoln's assassination as a kind of moment of reprieve from defeat were also worried because they considered him their best friend. Now, in true fashion, Lincoln being the great statesman he was, African Americans also considered Lincoln their best friend. So it's a very complicated moment where people are struggling to figure out what's going on, to figure out divine will, and this comparison with Christ is very important because it helps them get some sort of sense of divine intention. The first earthly person who mourners compare Lincoln to is George Washington, although African Americans do not make that comparison because Washington was a slaveholder. Then there's Moses, and as you mentioned, that's really important for African Americans. And then there's Christ, and that's something that both black and white mourners do in their comparisons.
And some of the, and I don't remember if this is in your book or in Lincoln's Body, the other book that written about Lincoln's assassination, where you mentioned that some of the Protestants were critical of Catholics because their ties to Rome and worshiping idols, praying to saints, yet they did the same thing by collecting relics from the assassination, and they knew that, even the doctors, when they did the autopsy, collecting locks of hair.
Yes, so you're referring to Richard Fox's wonderful book.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Body.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And he does talk more about that, about the disparagement of Catholics. But I do talk in Mourning Lincoln about the collection of relics. And partly what I came to realize by reading diaries and letters and personal writings is that people wanted to be a part of history. They understood how incredibly important this moment was, that it had changed the fate of the nation, maybe even the world. And so they saved their letters. So, for example, people would write letters and then say, of course, you didn't have a copy on your computer, you didn't have carbon paper. So people would write, please send me back this letter when you're finished reading it. It is my only record of what I did that day. Or they would collect, one of the main things they collected, speaking of relics, images of Lincoln, cheap postcards, expensive engravings, whatever they could afford. And then even that very night, it started that very night at Ford's Theater, as the crowds are rushing out of the theater, one government clerk in Washington rushes into the theater and up to the box and swipes the bloody collar that the doctors had removed from Lincoln's throat. And people save these and pass them down, and the ribbons and the mourning badges. People go to Peterson House. Ford's Theater is closed in the aftermath of the assassination, but they go to Peterson House, the boarding house where Lincoln died, and it's open for business, and they look at the bloody pillow. The proprietor left the pillow there for people to see. So people are making pilgrimages in all kinds of ways. They're deifying Lincoln. And that happened immediately. And I was surprised to find that it happened so immediately.
And I guess it's kind of like what you did the day after 9/11, buying newspapers, buying different things. Of course, you wanted it because you wanted to know what was going on. But at the same time, you know the significance of that day.
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, when I was thinking about the comparison, which I write about in the introduction to the book, I dug out just what you said. I dug out a carton that I had written on the top, 9/11, and I opened it up. There were newspapers. There were postcards of the Twin Towers, tourist postcards from when the Twin Towers were standing and tourists could buy them, and I knew that they wouldn't last because there were no more Twin Towers. There were whatever I could find that made the event seem somehow real. There were also photographs I had taken of signs that people had posted. We wanted some sort of memento. It seemed so unbelievable that it's one way to make it feel more real, and it's a way to mark your own participation in history.
It's interesting when we talked about some of the earlier events, like you mentioned, 9/11 or the Kennedy assassination. Of course, we were both young when that happened, and younger, and people must have looked at Lincoln's funeral and going, oh my gosh, this is incredible, because nobody had ever seen anything like this before. And this was also the first president who had been assassinated.
Yeah, that's right. So the funeral was an amazing event. So in some ways, there were older folks who remembered the funeral of George Washington, which in some ways, the planners of Lincoln's funeral modeled his funeral on Washington's. But of course, Washington was not assassinated. So it was a totally different kind of event. This was a funeral that began, there was a funeral in Washington 2 days after Lincoln died on Wednesday. There was a funeral in Washington 4 days after Lincoln died on Wednesday, April 19th. And then from there, a funeral train took him 1,700 miles across the country, a two-week journey ending in Springfield, Illinois, his hometown where he was buried. And in between, there were stops in 11 major cities, and in each city, there was another funeral. But not only the major cities, everywhere the funeral train passed by, just chugged through the countryside, people would come to see it. It could be 3 o'clock in the morning. It could be pouring rain, the ground filled with mud. People would bring their children, hold up their babies, take off their hats, fall to their knees and pray. This was an enormous marker of saying goodbye to President Lincoln, which also in many ways reflected the fact that people, everybody, had lost somebody during the Civil War. And because most bodies remained on the battlefield and couldn't be brought home for burial, it was a way to participate in a ritual of loss and mourning, not only for Lincoln, but for others who had died. And one of the things I found in diaries and letters was that when people would write about Lincoln's assassination, they would also mention, these are mourners, they would also mention loved ones who had died in the war. So there was a connection made by people between those losses.
Martha, we want to thank you very much for taking the time to be with us here today. We could talk for hours. We're running out of time, though. We've been visiting with Dr. Martha Hodes. Dr. Hodes is a professor of history at New York University. She is the author of the book, Mourning Lincoln. And Martha, do you have a website or somewhere else that people can go to find out more about, in detail, about the funeral or other things that we talked about, perhaps they want to find out more?
I have a website, just MarthaHodes.com, which is an author website, and on there you can find, you can click on other writings, where I've done some additional writing about the funeral and other press that's appeared, and you can find out about this book, Mourning Lincoln, and some of my other books, so that might be helpful to your listeners.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, and also thank you for listening.
Thank you so much, Louie. My pleasure.
Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTEP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Norma Martinez. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Luis Sainz. Mm-hmm.